We're starting a new topic today, which is electrons in a periodic potential. And this kind of follows our general philosophy where we're building up our description of a realistic solid. Remember, we started discussing electrons in a uniform background, the GLIO model. Then we talked a little bit about the bosonic excitations, phonons, among other things. Phonons represented the vibrations of the crystalline lattice. And now we get back to electrons, and we want to improve on our Gilliam description by actually including the effects of the lattice on the motion of electrons. And this is a kind of a bread and butter topic for conventional solid state physics. And if you had any solid state physics in your undergrad, you've probably seen this type of thing, because motion of electrons in periodic potential is what explains the distinction between metals and insulators, and is also key for understanding of semiconductors. And therefore, this has a huge applications in technology and engineering. All our electronics are based on basically this type of physics. So, we'll be looking at a single particle Hamiltonian of this form, quite simple, just a potential energy, kinetic energy of the electron, and a potential energy which has a property that it is periodic with the periodicity of the lattice, and this capital R is a lattice vector of the underlying crystal. So it's a vector that connects any two points of the crystalline lattice. And here's a one-dimensional depiction of this periodic potential. So basically, when you have a periodic lattice of ions, you expect the potential to have exactly the same periodicity, even if I didn't quite succeed in drawing it the right way. Okay, so this discussion always starts with the statement of the Bloch theorem, and let's do just that. Bloch theorem is a statement about the solutions of the Schrödinger equation with this Hamiltonian, and it says the following. It says that the eigenstates of H, which is given here, can be chosen to have the form psi and k of r is equal to e to the I k dot r times u and k of r with u and k of r plus capital R goes back to u and k of R. Okay, so this is the Bloch theorem that underlies all our understanding of this topic, electrons in a periodic potential. And once again, it says that solutions or eigenstates of this Hamiltonian can be chosen as a product of a plane wave times a function that has the same periodicity as the Hamiltonian. Okay, so you've probably seen this before. The somewhat surprising thing about this is that naively, maybe you would have thought that eigenstates of this Hamiltonian should be such that they have the full periodicity of the lattice, right? But that's not the case. There's always this plane wave factor in front of it, and the eigenstates actually have this somewhat more complicated form. which is often the case that solutions of a Schrödinger equation do not individually have the full symmetry of the Hamiltonian. And in this case, indeed, the solution itself is not quite symmetric under this translation, but it has a part that has that symmetry. There's an alternative statement of the Bloch theorem, which arises from asking the question, how does this psi transform under the symmetry, namely the translation? So I ask psi nk r plus capital R, what is this? And I just substitute on the right-hand side, and I see that when I substitute that shifted R in here, because of this property, it goes back to this, so that part doesn't shift, but I will get a contribution from here. So I can conclude that this is equal to the following. And in some texts, you can find this as a primary statement of the Bloch theorem, namely that when you shift the argument of the wave function by a lattice vector R, you pick up this exponential prefactor, but the wave function goes back to itself. And we will use the two as convenient. Any questions so far? So let's do the proof. There's a number of different proofs that one can give. This is a kind of elementary proof based on the property of translation operator. So we prove this theorem by defining a translation operator that we will call T of R, and it's defined as follows. When it acts on a function f of R, it simply translates it by the appropriate amount. Okay. Translations form a group, and it's a commutative group, so you can show that very easily that TR, TR prime is equal to TR prime TR, and this is equal to TR plus R prime, right? Meaning that when I translate by R first and R prime next, it's the same as doing it in the opposite order, and one can just translate one big translation by the sum of the two, and one gets precisely the same thing. This is not so, for instance, for the group of rotations, which form non-commutative groups, but for translations, the group structure is really simple. When one has a translation invariant Hamiltonian, the utility of this operator is that it commutes with the Hamiltonian. So TR H is equal to zero. So in other words, translations are the symmetry of the Hamiltonian. Now, what this means also is that we have two commuting operators, and we should be able then to take eigenstates of the Hamiltonian as simultaneous eigenstates of this translation operator. Okay, and that's what we will do. We will look at eigenstates that satisfy the Schrödinger equation, and at the same time, we will require them to be eigenstates of the translation operator, and we call the eigenvalue C of R, which in general can be some complex number because, we have not shown that translations are a Hermitian operator. Now, because of this property, one can show very easily that these eigenvalues of the translation question.
Against the equation for the translation, there should be psi.
Yes, there should be psi. Sorry about that. Like that. From this property, one can easily show that the same property holds for these eigenvalues. So, for instance, TR prime acting on psi is the same as TR plus R prime acting on psi. And this, by this definition, is CR plus R prime acting on psi, which then means that CR plus R prime is equal to CR C R prime. Okay, so these eigenvalues of the translation operator have this interesting property. And if you now look at this, that suggests that these C's have a form of an exponential, right? Because exponentials have precisely such property. E to a plus b is e to a times e to b. And indeed, that's going to be the case. So inspired by this observation, we write our r as n1 a1 plus n2 a2 plus n3 a3, where a j are primitive lattice vectors, and the n's are integers. And we assume that C of each primitive lattice vector, aj, has the following form, e to the 2 pi I xj, okay, where xj is some unknown number. In principle, it could be a complex number, but we will show that with proper boundary conditions, these are actually real numbers. Okay, so this form, once again, has a virtue that for two primitive vectors, A1 and A2, this equation is immediately satisfied. Now, from here, by repeatedly using this property, we can deduce what C of capital R is when this capital R has this form, right? And let me just write it down and see if everybody agrees with this. So this is going to be C A1 to power N1 times C A2 to power N2 times C A3 to power N3. Okay, and you just look at it for a moment, consider and see that indeed that what one obtains if my lattice vector is decomposed into a linear superposition of primitive vectors with integer coefficients, and there is this property, then this must be the case. Okay? But this is precisely equivalent to, according to this equation, of C of R having the form E to I K dot R with K equals X1 B1 plus X2 B2 plus X3 B3, where Bj are reciprocal lattice vectors. Reciprocal lattice primitive vectors. Defined by the usual condition that Bi dot Aj is 2 pi I, 2 pi delta Ij. In other words, if you take this form of K, plug it in, make an inner product of this guy here, and use that orthogonality relation, what you will get is E to I N1 X1, N2 X2, N3 X3, which is exactly what you would get from this equation here. And therefore, so once we have this, we can conclude that the Bloch theorem is indeed satisfied, because that's how we define our translation vector, namely TR applied on psi R is just psi R plus capital R psi. This is by definition of the translation operator. On the other hand, this is also equal to C of R times psi of R. That's from this definition. And if we take the form of C of R that we just derived, then we find that it's E to the I K dot R times psi of R. And if you now look at these two, this equality, then that's precisely the statement, this alternative statement of the Bloch theorem, which is completely equivalent to this statement. So this completes the general group theoretic proof of Bloch theorem. So, yes?
Can I ask, where did we use the fact that the psi's are eigenstates of the Hamiltonian?
Well, we used it only insofar as saying that psi is an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, but at the same time can be chosen as the eigenstate of, in other words, so what we've proven, it's a very good point actually. What we've proven does not really rely on the fact that psi is an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. We've proven that any function psi that has this translation, this property under translation, can be written in this form, right? And however, because according to this commutation relation, the wave function of the Hamiltonian can be always chosen as a simultaneous eigenstate of psi, then we can infer that all eigenstates of our Hamiltonian must have that form, right? So that's the whole point. This whole proof really only relies on the definition of the translation operator, and any eigenstate of the translation operator could be written in that form, even those that are not eigenstates of this Hamiltonian. But for those that are eigenstates of that Hamiltonian, this form holds, and therefore Bloch theorem is satisfied. Does that answer your question?
And does the fact that the operators commute imply that the eigenstates are the same?
When you have two commuting operators, according to the fundamental theorem of quantum mechanics, or linear algebra if you want, you can always choose the eigenstates that are common to both operators, right? Mm-hmm. That's what the theorem says here, right? Bloch's theorem says that the eigenstates of Hamiltonian can be chosen to have this form, right? I mean, you can choose them to not to be eigenstates of the translation operator if you wanted to, but that would be kind of foolish because then they would have a more complex form and would be more difficult to handle, right? Any other questions? Yes.
So right now the XIs are still, can be still complex?
Yeah, right now these XIs are just some general complex numbers, but in the next step we will now show that they actually have to be real numbers. Okay, and this goes under the name of Born von Karman boundary conditions. Which is just a fancy name for periodic boundary conditions, but in this context there is something more to it, and that's why we call it, following Ashcroft and Mermin, Born von Karman. They were the first people to come up with them. So we assume that we have periodic boundary conditions, namely when we shift the wave function by nj aj, then we get back to r, right? And notice that this is a different condition than this one here. When I shift by, so this r here means arbitrary lattice vector. This r can be a vector from here to there or from here to there between any two vectors. However, here I'm choosing some particular three numbers, n1, n2, and n3, which define my box in which my wave function is periodic. So basically, if I have a lattice with cubic symmetry, then I'm choosing my box, which this vector would be simply n1 times a1. This vector would be n3 times a3, sorry, with capital N, and so on. And generically, this is a large volume, so my a primitive unit cell, my atoms, are really small on this scale. Okay, so these n's are large numbers, they are integers, and n equals n1, n2, n3 is the total number of unit cells in a crystal. So this will be a thermodynamically large number, 10 to 24 in a typical crystal. Okay, so now let me just ask the question, what does this condition, when combined with the Bloch form of the wave function, what does that imply for my wave function, and specifically, what will that imply for the allowed values of these reciprocal vectors k, or momentum vectors k, rather. So let's write psi and k, and let's perform this shift for our Bloch wave function in j aj. This obviously is one of the lattice vectors because it has a form of an integer times a primitive lattice vector, and therefore I can use the Bloch theorem in its alternate form to remove this dependence, and I get nj k dotted to aj, I'm basically taking this to be my lattice vector times psi nk of r, okay? However, according to this boundary condition, I require that this is equal to psi nk of r, right? Which means that this guy has to be equal to 1. That's the only way I can satisfy both the Bloch theorem and my periodic boundary conditions. And this immediately implies when I, puts a constraint on my k, which is written here. Namely, I have to write that nj times k dot aj is equal to 2 pi times nj, where nj is, sorry, let me write it as m because I'm already using n for something else. So this is mj, and this is also an integer, okay? Now, k dotted into aj is, that's good. So k dotted into aj, according to this equation, we'll just pick up one of these components, right? Because only the inner product with the same indices of the reciprocal and primitive vectors give me 2 pi. Everything else gives me 0. So for instance, if I take j equals 1, I only pick up this component, and I get 2 pi from that inner product. So what this implies then, let me write it up here, is the following condition for xi's or xj's. These are equal to mj over capital Nj. And again, mj are integers. Okay. So what this implies is that this k, well, first of all, it implies that these xj's are real with periodic boundary conditions. And second, it implies that these values of k in the formulation of Bloch theorem can't just take any values. In fact, they take only discrete values of this form, integer divided by the size of my system. In thermodynamic limit, when this nj goes to infinity, these will be, well, quasi-continuous. But for any finite system, they have these discrete values. And specifically, k vector can be written as sum over j equals 1 to 3 mj divided by nj times d of j. And this is a kind of important formula to remember anytime you do some sort of calculation with periodic potentials. This crops up. There's one more interesting result that we can very quickly derive from this. And one can ask, what is the volume in reciprocal space per allowed value k? And this volume, delta k, is simply a volume given by three primitive vectors of this reciprocal lattice. So we can calculate it like this. B1, N1 dotted into B2 over N2 cross B3 over N3. And this is simply 1 over N times the volume of the unit cell of the primitive lattice. So we come to the conclusion that and this is an important conclusion, the number of allowed wave vectors K in a primitive cell of the reciprocal lattice is equal to the number of the unit cells of the crystal. And this is simply because of this factor 1 over n. This tells us that the volume per allowed wave vector k is 1 over n times the volume of the primitive cell. In other words, if you were to multiply this by n, it tells you that n such volumes give you a volume of the primitive cell in the reciprocal space, and therefore the total number of allowed wave vectors k is exactly equal to the number of unit cells in a real crystal. What that means here is that these mjs really are not supposed to range to infinity, but these mjs go between 1 and nj, right? And in other words, the k ranges only in the primitive cell of the reciprocal lattice, and the number of all allowed wave vectors in that region is exactly the same as the total number of unit cells in the crystal, which in practical computations translates to this requirement. And we will see, in fact, that how that plays out in practical calculations. Any questions about this? Okay, so what the plan is for the rest of the lecture, I will make some general remarks on a block theorem. And again, for most of you, this is just going to be a review of things that you've heard before. And then I will move on to a specific situation when one can see some practical consequences of this. And namely, I will discuss electrons in weak periodic potential, in which case one can actually solve this Schrödinger equation and see the Bloch theorem in action. And that's about what we will be able to do today. And then next time, I will discuss some other cases, specifically the so-called tight binding model when this can be also solved, and we will then discuss some consequences of these electrons in periodic potential, some of them being very important, like why we have metals and why we have insulators and so on. Okay, so some general remarks. And I have to ask you now to bear with me for maybe next 20 minutes. So some of you will have seen this already, and it will seem very trivial. If you haven't seen it before, then some of these things might look a bit mysterious. But when we go to specific examples, hopefully everything will become a bit clearer. So remark number one is that K is not a momentum. It is a crystal momentum. And often we will call K a momentum, but one has to remember that it is not a momentum in a sense that it is not an eigenvalue in a crystal of a momentum operator. And this is simply because once you have a periodic potential, translational invariance is broken and momentum is no longer conserved, right? Conservation of momentum is a consequence of translation invariance of free space. Once you break that translational invariance, then a momentum is no longer conserved, because as electron even classically moves in a potential, it has forces acting on it. And when you have forces acting on a body, of course its momentum will change. So let's just check that explicitly. Let's act with a momentum operator P on a wave function psi and k, which is the same as to say, let's just put H bar properly here, psi and k. And I use the first form of the wave function from the Bloch theorem and see what happens. So this is minus I H bar gradient is acting to e to the I k dot small r times u and k of r. And you can see right away that when I use a product rule to do this, then the first piece gives me a k down, as you would expect for a momentum eigenstate. However, there is the other piece which spoils this. And the result that I get when I perform this operation is h bar k acting on psi and k plus e to I k dot r h bar over I gradient acting on u and k of r. And so this first part looks like k is something like momentum, but of course there's the second part coming from this non-zero gradient. So indeed, k cannot be really thought of as being an eigenvalue of the momentum operator. Momentum operator does not have, in general, sharp eigenvalues in the eigenstates of the particle in a periodic potential. Nevertheless, this k, we will see that k is conserved modular reciprocal lattice vector. So it has some usefulness, and for that reason, we call it crystal momentum. It is related to momentum. Okay, remark number two. The wave vector k can be always confined into the first Brillouin zone or in principle any other primitive cell of the reciprocal space. And this is because if K is not in the first Brillouin zone, then it can always be written as so because if K prime is not in first Brillouin zone, then we can write it as K prime equals K plus G, where G is a reciprocal lattice vector and K is in first Brillouin zone. So this is G is a reciprocal lattice vector and K is inside the first Brillouin zone. We can always find a reciprocal lattice vector to shift it back to the first Brillouin zone. And the two states described by K prime and K describe the same state of the system. Namely, they satisfy, they are the same state. So if I write psi r plus capital R as being e to the I k dot k prime dot capital R psi of R. Now I perform this shift, right? So I write it as e to the I k dot R times e to the I g dot R psi of R. But this is always one by definition of a reciprocal lattice vector. So this ultimately is just e to the I k dot R psi of R, which means that a wave function with a vector k prime and k is in fact the same wave function in this Bloch theorem, just because of this defining property of reciprocal lattice vectors. So the third remark concerns this index n that kind of mysteriously appeared in the Bloch theorem, and I didn't say anything about it. So let's explain what this is. Index n in psi and k is a so-called band index, and it labels independent solutions of the Schrödinger equation for a given k. So how does this work? Well, what I always want, I want to solve the Schrödinger equation h psi n k, or let's just write it like this. H psi is equal to epsilon psi, right? Now I write my Hamiltonian as written up there in line one. H acting on psi is simply h bar squared over 2m. Do it like this. Laplace plus u of r acting on psi. But let me write this psi using the Bloch theorem, namely this form, right? And then you can see what happens. I can actually use my Laplace operator to pull down k squared factor in from this term, and then derive just an equation for this u for this periodic part, right? So this can be written as e to the I k dot r, and what I'm left with in here is h bar squared over 2m minus I gradient plus k plus u of r acting on just the periodic part of my wave function. And this is equal to the left-hand side, so let me write this down like e to the I k dot r epsilon u of r. Now, let's just look at this equation here. We can obviously cancel out these two pieces, so we get an equation for the periodic part of the potential. And this is just a Schrödinger equation, and this should be squared here. For each value of k, I get an independent Schrödinger equation. But of course, I expect this Schrödinger equation not to have just one solution, but to have some discrete number of, typically it will have infinitely many solutions, just like a harmonic oscillator, for instance, in one dimension or in 3D. And I label those by this index n. Okay. So this has infinitely many solutions for each k, and we label them by index n. Okay, let me now make the final remark. And this concerns the group velocity of electrons. Electron in a Bloch state has a non-vanishing average velocity, and this velocity in each band is given by the following simple expression. So this is basically just a relation for the group velocity. And for instance, you can check that if this epsilon k was just the usual quadratic dispersion, h bar squared k squared over 2m, you would get a velocity that is simply h bar k over m, as you would expect for a velocity in a plane wave to be. More generally, you can derive this expression, and I will not go over that derivation, but if you haven't seen it before, then you can look it up in Ashcroft and Merman. It's given in the appendix. It's a kind of short derivation where you simply calculate the expectation value of the velocity operator for the Bloch wave function and can be manipulated to this form. And this will be useful, for instance, when we're calculating things like electrical current. We will need to know what the velocity of the electron is, and we will use this formula. Okay, this concludes the general remarks section. Are there any questions? So let me now move on to a concrete application of these general things that we mentioned. So, you see, generally, I mean, to proceed from here, we would now kind of want to start solving the Schrödinger equation for the periodic part, because this is what contains the information about the problem, right? Now, of course, we can only do it, or seemingly we can only do it for a specific potential. We cannot start solving it for abstract periodic potential. On the other hand, it turns out that motion in periodic potential has these generic features which one can obtain even without specifying a precise form of this periodic potential. And one situation where this can be demonstrated basically by hand without going to some numerical calculations is when this periodic potential is weak, in the sense that we can treat it as a small perturbation to this kinetic energy part, okay? And in that case, we will see that it doesn't really matter what form precisely that potential has. As long as it has a property of periodicity and is weak, we can get some interesting results out of this. So let's write our Hamiltonian again as h bar squared Laplace over 2m plus U of R, where this is a periodic potential, and we call this H naught, and we call this H prime, and we will assume that this U is sufficiently weak so that we can treat it as a perturbation to a large kinetic energy piece. And again, I just emphasize that this has a periodicity property. And from this periodicity property, it also, one can deduce that we will need a Fourier transform of this. And the Fourier transform of a periodic potential has a property that it only has Fourier components at reciprocal lattice vectors G, right? And to check that, you can simply test that these vectors G have to be such that when you shift this by R, your R appears here. But of course, what you need is that e to the I R dot G is equal to 1. So these Gs are indeed in the reciprocal lattice. So, and that's going to be the key property. If you just had a general potential without any periodicity property, then you would have to sum over all vectors k. However, for a periodic potential, you only sum over those vectors that satisfy this this property here, namely reciprocal lattice vectors. This is valid for all R. Okay, so there's a number of ways one can proceed. Now, the kind of simplest way, since we invested in formalism of second quantization, is to rewrite this Hamiltonian in second quantized form, and then everything comes out very simple. So let's do second quantization. So H naught we can just write down immediately. It's going to be sum over k and sigma epsilon k c dagger k sigma ck sigma, where epsilon k is just h bar squared k squared over 2m, right? This is just the kinetic energy. We had that many times, so we don't need to elaborate on that. So all we need to do is just derive the second quantized form of this periodic potential. We haven't done that before. It's nevertheless quite easy. So H prime in second quantized form, it's a single body potential, so we know what to do. We simply need to calculate the matrix element of this potential between the basis states, which are plane wave states in this case, right? And so basically we need to calculate this matrix element. This matrix element, K sigma U K prime sigma prime, is just, let me just specify here that our basis states are, as usual, 1 over V e to the I K dot R. Since we're starting from this as our unperturbed system, we better take the eigenstates of that Hamiltonian, and these are just plane waves. So this thing here is simply 1 over V. I can immediately perform the spin inner product. This is going to be sigma sigma prime, because I'm assuming that my potential is diagonal in spin, doesn't act on spin degrees of freedom. And then I have to perform an integral of d3r of my potential sandwiched between the two wave functions. So I get e2 minus I k dot r u of r e to the I k prime dot r. But this is nothing but a Fourier transform of u of r, and let's just perform that Fourier transform. So this is delta sigma sigma prime over V. I can write my U of R in this form. So I write it as sum over reciprocal lattice vectors U of G, and then I have a integral d3r here of all these factors, which is simply e to minus ir k minus k prime minus g, right? I'm simply substituting for u of r this expansion, and this integral I can now immediately evaluate. This is nothing but the volume delta k minus k prime g. And once I have this, I can just substitute this matrix element into there. And this H prime simply is sum over K, K prime, sigma, sigma prime, delta, sigma, sigma prime, sum over G, delta, K minus K prime, G, U of G, C dagger K, sigma, C K prime, sigma prime. And now I see I have four summations here and two deltas, so I can perform some of these summations. And what's left here is the following. I'm left with summation over K, G, and sigma. And I'm left with U of G, C dagger, K plus G, sigma, CK, sigma. Okay? So this is a this is the form of this potential term with periodic potential in second quantization. And what I can conclude by looking at this Hamiltonian is that what periodic potential does, it scatters electrons. It takes an electron in a crystal momentum, in a momentum K, and annihilates it and recreates the electron in a different momentum state, K plus G, where G is one of the reciprocal lattice vectors, and the amplitude for this process is U of G, which is just a Fourier transform of the U periodic potential at that wave vector. Okay. So basically, electron in this language, electron moving in the crystal, can be thought of as electron moving and undergoing these scattering events in which its momentum changes by one of the reciprocal lattice vectors with these particular amplitudes. Okay. So now let us assume that these scattering amplitudes are weak, and let us try to solve the problem in perturbation theory. And I make two additional assumptions. For simplicity and clarity, I will consider now a 1D system. And I will suppress the spin index. Spin here doesn't do anything. It's just around for the ride. There's nothing happening to the spin, so I will just suppress this index. I will just remember there's two spin species that ultimately I have to sum over. And three, I will assume that U at G equals zero is equal to zero. So the zero component of this potential just gives me a constant offset to my periodic potential. And I will simply take that to be zero, which means that I adjust my zero of my energy. If this is non-zero, I just absorb it to some overall constant. It doesn't really do anything. I can always redefine where my energy zero is. Any questions at this point? So let's do perturbation theory. In this H prime, I will apply the perturbation theory to the state of the system K, which is simply C dagger K acting on the vacuum. So I will ask, I just send one electron through the crystal, I give it momentum K, namely I create an electron with that momentum, and I will ask, how is this state modified by the action of this perturbation? Okay. So to zeroth order, I will just calculate energies. One can do the wave functions as well. To zeroth order, I simply have energy E of K, which is the eigenvalue of the unperturbed Hamiltonian. Nothing really extremely interesting there. Let's go to first order. So to first order in perturbation theory, I have to calculate a matrix element of K of my perturbation. And I will shift my notation slightly. So instead of summing over K in that H prime, I will sum over Q so that it doesn't interfere with this K because it's a dummy summation variable. UG C dagger Q plus G C G K. Okay. Sorry, this should be Q. And you can see how one can calculate this matrix element. Basically, it's only non-zero when Q is equal to K, right? Otherwise, there's no other electrons. I just have one electron at momentum K. So in order for this to be able to annihilate that electron, I need Q in this sum to be equal to G, sorry, to K. And once that is done, then I annihilate that electron, and I will end up with the following sum over G, U of G, K, C dagger, K plus G, acting on a vacuum state. And again, in order for this to give me non-zero, the only way this can happen is when this operator recreates that electron in state K. So this will only be non-zero when G is equal to zero. So ultimately, I end up with U0 as my result for first order perturbation theory. But by my assumptions, this is zero. So in first order perturbation theory, I don't really get anything, at least naively at this point. Now notice that if I didn't make this assumption that UG of zero is zero, then I would just get some constant. And again, this would just be some overall shift to my all my energy. So I don't really care about that. Now, more interesting things start happening in second order. So let's do that. And in second order, remember what we calculate is an expression like this, epsilon k prime minus epsilon k. And upstairs here, I have a matrix element like so. So I'm compelled now to calculate a matrix element just like before, but now K and K prime are different. And let me just write the result here. One can calculate it in exactly the same way. And the result for this matrix element is like this. Okay. So this is the result for that matrix element, and indeed, everybody can check that. This is what you obtain. So what I then do, I just take this, plug it into my second order perturbation theory and obtain the following result. And it's sum over K prime, sum over G, G prime. And one thing that I will put a prime here on this summation, which will remind me that in this sum, I need to avoid the term where K prime is equal to K, right? That term be divergent, and it's not part of the perturbation series. So I put that prime there, not to forget about this. And the result looks like this. I'm getting a U star of G. In general, these components can be complex. And as you know, if when you flip the two parts of this matrix element, then you get a matrix element complex conjugated. Anyway, one can now perform some of these summations. Namely, I can perform here a summation over K prime using, well, both of those deltas are actually the same, so they give me just the same delta. Is that true? So anyway, performing this summation after a brief hesitation, because I seem to have a mistake in my notes, but this is now fixed. Okay, so this is the result. Basically, I perform summation over K prime, and then I'm left with just this. So I can perform a summation over a G prime, and then I just get one simple sum like this. So this prime just reminds me to avoid G equals zero, because at that point, the two of them will be equal, and this would be ill-defined. So now, if I look at this expression and analyze it for physical content, then I might be a bit disappointed because, so in first order perturbation theory, I'm assuming small potential u, so presumably all these numbers here, u of g, are small. And in first order perturbation theory, I didn't get anything. In second order perturbation theory, I get some small number to power 2, so it looks like this periodic potential doesn't do much, at least naively. However, here's why this would not really be true. So clearly, if this is small, right, if the denominator should become close to 0, then even a small matrix element here could lead to a large perturbation. And indeed, this is actually what happens at some special point in momentum space. And let me draw a sketch for you. How does this happen? So let me draw these energies like this. So this is K. And let me just draw the unperturbed energy here around 0, which is just my parabola. So this is my epsilon K. Right, which is just h bar squared k squared over 2m. And here in the denominator, what I have is a difference between epsilon k, which is this parabola, and epsilon k shifted by some reciprocal lattice vector. So let's say my reciprocal lattice vector g1 is here. Let this be the smallest reciprocal lattice vector. So I have to draw a similar parabola here, right? So this is now my epsilon k minus g1. And I see that pretty much everywhere, this denominator will not be small, but at this point here, right, which I call, well, which is 1/2 g1, I find that this denominator is actually 0, even though this condition here is satisfied. So it's not the term that I should omit from my second order perturbation theory, this is actually a legitimate term. Right? So in here, epsilon k minus g1 is equal to epsilon epsilon k, and my perturbation series is actually ill-defined because this term is zero in the denominator. And there, in fact, will be infinitely many such points because I have to sum over all reciprocal lattice vectors g, which means that I will have another point like that on the other side. There will be another parabola that goes like this. This is another point, but there will be these paraboli everywhere. There will be another one at g2, and so this will have another intersection there, and so on. So there will be infinitely many but discrete points at all reciprocal lattice vectors and their fractions at which this denominator vanishes and the perturbation theory breaks down. So the conclusion here is or at least simple-minded perturbation theory breaks down when epsilon k minus g is equal to epsilon k because at these points I have a degeneracy. Namely, at these points, the energy level associated with this parabola is degenerate, exactly degenerate, with the energy level associated with a shifted parabola. And there will be infinitely many such points. And so at those points, even though my potential, periodic potential, can be arbitrarily weak, the effect of the periodic potential is expected to be very strong. So even for weak potential U of R, the effect is strong, or can be potentially strong once I have treated it properly, right? Now, at this point, it just indicates the breakdown of the ordinary perturbation theory. Then I have to do better. And what I need to do, I have to take an unpopular step and employ the degenerate perturbation theory. And this is going to be the last thing I want to do. So I will employ, and let me call it nearly degenerate. So notice specifically that these points of degeneracy will be associated with one half of my all my reciprocal lattice vectors. This is not really drawn right. G1 should be one half of G2, so you know this should be at that point. I didn't quite draw the parabola right. So let's just take in particular this point where k is equal to 1 half G1, and I'm calling it nearly degenerate perturbation theory because it's strictly speaking degenerate only precisely at that one point of k equals 1 half of a reciprocal lattice vector, but I will apply it in the vicinity of this point as well, and this is fine, as you will see. I will learn something from this calculation. So basically, if you recall your quantum mechanics education, degenerate perturbation theory tells you that what you should do is to consider the degenerate states, in this case two of them, and calculate all the matrix elements of the full Hamiltonian between these degenerate states, and then diagonalize that matrix to find the actual eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. So I have two states that are nearly degenerate near this point, and I will call them state one, which is the state at momentum k, and state two, which is a state at momentum k minus g1. And what I then want to do, I want to form a matrix H alpha beta, which has the following form, 1H1, 1H2, 2H1, and 2H2. So this is the matrix of my full Hamiltonian in the subspace of these degenerate states. And I need to evaluate this matrix and then diagonalize it to find what the actual eigenstates are in the presence of this perturbation. Now, these matrix elements, we already evaluated them before. So let me just write the result. And again, everybody can evaluate these matrix elements. This 2x2 matrix, when I evaluate them, looks like this. Epsilon k u of g1 u star of g1 epsilon k minus g1. And, you know, it's kind of obvious that that's all that you can get. The diagonal element just gives you the kinetic energy. The off-diagonal element just gives you potential energy associated with the wave vector that connects those two states. There's nothing really else that one can conceivably get. And so what we need to do, we need to find an energy, the two energy eigenvalues of this 2x2 matrix. So what I will do, I will just write the secular equation for that problem. I set the determinant to zero. And from this, I can solve for these eigenenergies. And I find that there is two of them. And they have the following form, epsilon k plus epsilon k minus g plus minus square root of 1 quarter epsilon k minus epsilon k minus g squared plus ug of squared. These are the two eigenvalues. And this is for general k. Now, when I focus this is something actually that is maybe worth remembering. If I focus on k exactly equal to 1/2 of g, then I find that epsilon k, sorry, ek is simply epsilon k plus minus absolute value u of g. So what I see is that at these points of degeneracy, the periodic potential is actually splitting my degenerate energy levels to two distinct levels. And let me now try to plot what happens. I can do it either there, or let me do it here. So again, this is k. This is my original parabola. And this is my second parabola. Okay. So this is my epsilon k minus g, unperturbed solutions. Now, I could plot this expression, and let me do that in colored chalk. And basically what I find is that it looks like this. So basically, the perturbation is very small everywhere else, but is large at the degeneracy point, right? So this is G1, this is 1/2 AG, and its main effect is to open up a gap. Twice U of G, which is also often called avoided crossing. And this is one of the fundamental results of the theory, solid-state physics. Basically, even a very weak potential has a strong effect at these special points in the Brillouin zone when it any crossing that you have for which a matrix element of the periodic potential is non-zero opens up a gap, and this, as we will see, will ultimately be responsible for the fact that silicon is an insulator, whereas aluminum is a metal. So any material that is crystalline and it's insulating, this type of physics is responsible for that phenomenon. Now, so the general recipe when you're doing this weak periodic potential is as follows, and I will reiterate next time with some slides. You basically draw all these paraboli shifted by all reciprocal lattice vectors, and you find points at which they cross, and then you replace all crossings with anti-crossings. Okay. Now, you can see why I did this in one dimension rather than in three dimensions. In one dimension, we can plot these type of simple plots. In three dimensions, of course, these paraboli are three-dimensional, so they overlap in planes, and the gap opens up along those planes. This is somewhat difficult to picture, and again, I will bring some slides next time and show you how this is typically done. But the take-home message today is that even a weak potential can have a strong effect on the dispersion relation of an electron in that it changes a crossing between bands into an anti-crossing, and that's ultimately responsible for insulating behavior of many crystals, as we will discuss in more detail later. Any questions about this? Okay, then this is all for today, and I see you tomorrow.